Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. Hello, welcome to this week's programme. I'm Hannah Godfrey. Coming up in the programme, we go to northern France, where immigrants are still trying to get across the English Channel illegally, and to Britain, where Polish immigrants have become part of the landscape. In Stockholm, there's an initiative to link up Roma journalists from across Europe. We go to a Romanian film festival in Transylvania. And finally, we'll take a look at the sometimes murky business of World Cup sponsorship. More than 3 years after the closure of the Red Cross camp in Songet, northern France, NGOs are blowing the whistle. They're concerned about the humanitarian situation of asylum seekers, as there are still around 500 migrants roaming in the nearby city of Calais. Tougher asylum laws in Britain have failed to act as a deterrent, as migrants are still making daily attempts to sneak into ferries crossing the Channel. The issue of illegal immigration was one of the focal points of this week's European Council summit in Brussels. Radio France International's Nick Schompel reports from Calais.
Calais, two steps away from England. That's what a billboard reads on the A26 highway to the busy harbour. Every half hour, a ferry leaves the port of the northern Côte d'Opale coast, as it's called, for the White Cliffs of Dover. It takes 90 minutes to get across the channel, which is nothing compared to the thousands of miles migrants have had to endure to get here.
The Afghans, the Pakistans, the Africans from Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, everybody here is desperate to cross over to Britain.
This tall Sierra Leonean and other migrants live in rat-infested squats on the docks. Potato ragu, radish and yogurt, Calais migrants rarely miss the evening meal, served at 6 o'clock in front of the Paul Deveau warehouse near the squats. There are about 200 of them tonight. Michael Lauvergne from the CESUR non-profit organization is asking them to wait patiently in line to get served, but it's not easy.
You see, they're all pushing, trying to cheat to get served first. This shows you that they are really starving. That's because apart from non-profit organizations, nobody deals with the humanitarian side of things anymore. The authorities focus on nothing but repression. This week, for instance, as we were distributing clean clothes to these people, police officers stormed in and arrested a dozen people.
Les CRS ont profité de la distribution de vêtements pour interpeller des migrants.
Each day, Calais is the scene of a modern Western. Being chased by police on an empty stomach is exhausting. But most migrants say there is no turning back, even if asylum laws in England are now tougher.
Zabiullah Safi, I am from Pakistan. We sold all of our land, our houses, and we get this money to reach here, to reach London. We can find work there, our relatives are there. In France, we can't. There is not ways to find work here. There is danger in our country. Our life is in danger. So we will cry for our rights.
The atmosphere after the meal is quite upbeat. Migrants often play football, volleyball, or sing, waiting for nightfall. That's when a small group will head to the last roundabout before the ferry terminal. Lorries often have to stop there because of traffic for a couple of minutes, just enough time to hide under a lorry or sneak into a compartment. They're prepared to repeat several attempts over weeks. Many locals in Calais are sympathetic and donate clothes, fresh underwear, towels and soap to migrants. But at the counter of the Marinerie Café near the docks, Guy and his friends say they will never make any donations whatsoever.
No, because there are too many of them. There's no end to it. They'll keep showing up as long as we give them food. Because, see, now they're coming from Africa, there are more and more blacks. From Senegal, for instance. There's no war in Senegal. Okay, they don't have any work, but we can't take in all of the world's poor, and we shouldn't let them take our jobs either.
Andri Ramayiri Manana disagrees. He works for the CIMAD NGO, which helps migrants deal with the paperwork and informs them of their rights. He says Calais is a good way of assessing the map of world conflicts.
Most people who came to Sangatte 6 years ago were from Afghanistan. Later it was Iraqis, right after the war there. Then we had many Sudanese because of the situation in Darfur. And now there's an increasing number of people from Somalia in Calais. So you see, Calais is in many ways a mirror of the geopolitical situation.
Opposite the police headquarters and the temporary detention center where migrants are held, there is a gigantic futuristic shopping mall called Europe City. It's popular among the British, who can easily cross the channel, stock up wine and beer because it's cheaper, and then cross the channel back home. But for these migrants, such luxuries are as distant as their native countries. Calais, Nick Champeau, RFI.
Luckier migrants enter the UK through the front door. Up to 2 million Poles are thought to have settled in EU countries since Poland joined the Union in 2004. Many of these have opted to settle in Britain with its open labour market. Michał Kubicki looks at the consequences of emigration on this scale.
It's difficult to define the exact number of Poles who've used their country's accession to the EU as an opportunity to head west in search of better jobs and wages. In the UK alone, according to Home Office statistics, some 250,000 Poles are employed, over 60% of all new immigrants from the bloc's new member states. Because most of the old EU states have imposed restrictions on their labour markets, the majority of Poles have opted for the UK, Ireland, Sweden and most recently Spain, which have opened their markets. The figures do not tell the full story of movement across the continent's old Iron Curtain. Some people take seasonal jobs. Those who are self-employed do not need to register at all. But analysts of the labour market, both in Poland and abroad, agree that this is one of the largest immigration waves from a single country. What are the consequences of the exodus of Poles? Sociologist Piotr Kwiatkowski stresses that Polish society is getting older, and so the current immigration trend is likely to be a source of social problems.
People who are going abroad, they are people who are relatively young, entrepreneurial and well-educated. We are not thinking only about people with higher education, like doctors or engineers, specialists in the area of IT, but also a lot of fully qualified people in the area of construction, nurses, drivers. They are looking for new opportunities in the European Union.
With unemployment in Poland standing at around 17%, a growing number of young Poles take their chances in countries where their skills are appreciated. In a recent public opinion survey, 61% of Poles expressed the view that young Poles who've achieved professional success abroad should return to Poland. Piotr Kwiatkowski says that this would be beneficial for the Polish economy.
I hope that at least part of those people will earlier or later come back to Poland and they will bring new habits, they will bring, I would say, new experience to our culture, to our reality.
According to the same survey, only one in every four Poles currently working abroad is planning to return. There is no doubt that much will depend on the economic and political situation in Poland. A decision to emigrate is rarely taken overnight, but many of this year's university graduates cite the overall political climate as one of the reasons why they intend to seek job opportunities abroad. I'm Michał Kubicki for News from Poland.
Europe's Roma community suffers arguably even worse discrimination than do immigrants. Journalism is frequently responsible for blackening the name of this minority, who often live on the fringes of mainstream society. But it can equally be used to inform, as prejudice is often born simply out of ignorance. Azaria Kiros reports on a meeting of Romani journalists from across Europe that took place in Stockholm recently and found out about the special difficulties faced by reporters from this community.
Their situation varies from country to country, but most of them live in squalid conditions on the outskirts of European cities. You ask any Roma, and you soon find out the Roma, as a group, are the victims of widespread prejudice and consistent discrimination. But what is the role of the Romani journalist in all this? The international branch of Swedish radio, SR International, is holding a conference for Roma journalists from all over Europe. The question is, how much freedom do Roma journalists in Europe have to cover Roma stories freely and, if need be, critically? Sarah Rockström is deputy head of SR International.
Because our programming is done by Roma journalists, they have to be very careful. They have to tread a very fine line because, of course, they're public service journalists, so they're not going to avoid any subjects. But on the other hand, they have to treat them sensitively. For example, it could be subjects to do with sex, to do with early marriages, child marriages. Any questions concerning those matters are very sensitive, and our journalists have to be careful they don't offend people. If they offend people, they're not going to get interviews.
And Jack Bowers from the BBC's Romani service says Romani journalists sometimes find it difficult to draw the line between their profession and their loyalty to their people.
There is a conflict in that most people I know who have become Romani journalists were first Romani activists. They've come to this from a political direction, that they want to tell the truth about their community, so they are generally passionate people. So there is a conflict between being a presenter and a representative of the truth and the representative of the people. I think it's a problem for all Romani journalists, wherever they are, is that your first loyalty is to your people. But as a journalist, your first loyalty is to the truth. And there can be a conflict there. As a journalist, it is your job to look at the difficult issues. That is what makes good journalism, makes good programming. As a representative of your people, your job is to represent your people, to say the good side of your people, not necessarily to look at the bad side.
That was Azaria Kiros reporting from Stockholm. There's so much picturesque mythology surrounding the Roma or Gypsy people that cinema seems to find it hard to treat the theme without being seduced into showing singing and dancing round the campfire. Even when the director is one of them, like Tony Gatliff, who was born to Algerian and Spanish Gypsy parents. Transylvania, which is Gatliff's second film, centred on the Romanian Roma, was the closing piece at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Iulian Remezan reports from the city of Cluj on the Transylvania International Film Festival, where, naturally, Gatliff's new film featured prominently.
Gadjodilo was Tony Gatliff's first movie about Romanian gypsy life and music. At the 1997 Locarno Film Festival, it was cheered as authentic, passionate, visceral, pulsating and full-blooded. But his second and latest film, shot in Romania, which is again about the Roma ways, provoked quite a debate among Romanian audiences at the 5th Transylvania International Film Festival in Cluj. Tony Gatliff expressed his fascination with the people and the music of Transylvania.
What fascinated me when I travelled through Romania was not the landscape, but people's faces. And I was fascinated by the faces of the people from Transylvania, because they preserve a truth, an authenticity that cannot be found anywhere else in Europe. Then it was the music. All my films talk about music.
Some Romanian viewers think the movie does not paint a realistic image of Transylvania, and it might mislead foreign audiences into believing that Transylvania is a backward province inhabited by superstitious gypsies, Hungarians and Romanians, who do nothing but drink, dance, beg and steal. An exchange of diverging views between a leading Romanian actor in the audience and Tony Gatliff on stage ended with the director saying, "Je suis désolé." So it seems that even a smaller festival like the Transylvania International Film Festival did not escape the political. Tony Gatliff's Transylvania did not receive any notable award. Instead, the Best Movie Award went to Romanian Corneliu Porumboiu for his East of Bucharest, a slapstick comedy about whether or not there was an anti-communist revolution in 1989 in a remote village in Moldavia, eastern Romania. Corneliu Porumboiu's film also received this year's Camera d'Or award in Cannes, confirming that a new generation of Romanian filmmakers are determined to put Romania on the map of European film. Honorary director of TIFF, Tudor Giurgiu, thinks Cluj is already a very hot place for European film lovers.
Transylvania International Festival, which is now the fifth edition, is really among the highlights of all the festival circuit in southeastern Europe. I think after Sarajevo is like the second biggest event, biggest film event. And I think especially during the last 2 years, it grew a lot because it involved many films, many international guests coming, and also foreign press representatives. There were more people coming, I think, just because there was a big success of Romanian films in Cannes. We got 3 prizes over there. So I think Romania becomes now a very hot place, not just because there were foreign productions coming to shoot here, but also due to this big success of Romanian films.
Anything but boring. For 10 days, the city of Cluj in central Romania was a blend of cool Europe, ethno-Balkans and politics.
That was Julian Marezan, reporting from Cluj, Romania. You're listening to Network Europe, a partnership of international broadcasters. And now it's time for this week's Brussels briefing. Stephen Castle reports on the week which saw the beginning of detailed negotiations with Turkey over EU membership.
It's just 8 months since Turkey's ambitions to join the EU almost came to grief on the very day that historic membership talks were launched. At the start of October 2005, EU officials in Luxembourg worked frantically to defuse a diplomatic row. Meanwhile, the Turkish delegation waited in Ankara, refusing to board their plane until the dispute was resolved. This week, the scene in the EU's drab conference centre in Luxembourg was so similar that one could be forgiven for a strong sense of déjà vu. Once again, diplomats haggled over the wording of obscure pieces of text. Once again, a Turkish aircraft waited on the tarmac at Ankara Airport. And once again, the deal was only done after hours of anxiety. No one ever thought that EU membership talks with Turkey would be easy. For one thing, they're expected to last at least a decade. This week's talks were the first of 35 sets of detailed negotiation on specific areas of policy. The subject matter, science and technology, was specially chosen because it is uncontentious. But diplomats know that the crisis has only been postponed. In the autumn, the Turks will be asked to permit all EU ships, including those from Cyprus, to enter Turkish ports. Ankara has already agreed to do so in principle because it expanded a customs union to all EU countries. However, Turkey is refusing to implement the accord unless the EU eases the economic isolation of Turkish-dominated northern Cyprus. This is something the EU promised to do when the northern Cypriots backed a UN plan to reunify the island. But concrete measures are being blocked by the official Cypriot government in Nicosia. This seemingly intractable problem is bad enough. But behind the scenes, the political mood is grim too. The EU fears that, since last October, the pace of internal reform in Turkey has slowed dramatically. Ankara seems increasingly convinced that the EU will never allow such a large, predominantly Muslim country to join it. The tone of the political debate in France and Germany has only reinforced that suspicion. When EU leaders met in Brussels this week, one of the items on the agenda was the future of EU enlargement. Some countries want a clearer statement that the bloc will only admit new nations if it can absorb them. A country like Turkey, with a population of 70 million, is hardly going to be easy to absorb. All of which means that this week's drama over Turkey was really only a dress rehearsal. The real battle looms in the autumn. Expect some sharp political exchanges, some tense negotiating, and another long night in Luxembourg. This is Stephen Castle in Brussels.
In case you hadn't noticed, the biggest football championship in the world is taking place in Germany at the moment. Inevitably, big business makes the most of an event of this kind. But the World Cup's commercialisation has reached epic proportions. FIFA has set the price of transmitting images of the game so high that most media in the developing world have not been able to buy them. So many people are being deprived of watching this much-loved event. Emirates Airlines, McDonald's, MasterCard and all the other brands crowd in to try and profit from the feel-good factor that surrounds the championships. and VIP areas, the World Cup lottery, and the privileges of sponsors have created a gap that leaves the poor fan on the outside, looking in. Even now, German investigators are probing one sponsor, the NBW Energy Group, which stands accused of giving match tickets to politicians and government employees. Peter Zimmermann reports from Berlin.
German football fans are disappointed. Sponsors, the press and politicians had a much better chance of getting tickets. People who are normally not even interested in football. And the fans have a point. Some 500,000 of the World Cup's 3 million tickets went to just 21 companies. FIFA's 15 main sponsors each paid 40 million euros for marketing rights.
It's your Heimspiel. Make it real. Coca-Cola.
Now the district attorney's office in the city of Karlsruhe is investigating the head of a large German utility provider. Utz Klaasen, chief executive of the NBW Energy Group, is under fire for giving away free match tickets to politicians and government employees.
Nach Einschätzung all der Menschen, die uns rechtlich beraten, gibt
our legal advisors are of the opinion that there is no judicial basis for preliminary proceedings against us.
Zuzufügen.
NBW Energy Group is one of the six national World Cup sponsors. It has acquired the right from FIFA to use the World Cup for marketing purposes and to buy some of the rare tickets. According to NBW Chief Executive Klaasen, the energy giant bought 13,600 tickets, ranging from 45 to 100 euros.
We're having a gigantic party. More than 90% of our tickets go to our customers and our staff.
Ins Stadion bringen können.
But the district attorney investigated at least seven politicians in the state of Baden-Württemberg, including the CDU's economics minister Ernst Pfister. Karlsruhe district attorney Rainer Borg said they reacted positively to offers of free match tickets.
Für die Dienstausübung in diesem Sinne ist ein
The law is very clear. Sponsors are absolutely not allowed to grant any advantages to public representatives with whom they have official ties.
Zu dem Amtsträger pflegen soll.
Ubi, Deutschlands Nummer 1 geht ins Finale mit vielen Weltmeisterangeboten.
Since the start of these proceedings, World Cup sponsors like Obi Supermarkets, Adidas Sportswear, German Rail and Postbank are said to be holding back invitations to politicians and public representatives. NBW Energy Group is reported to have paid 3.4 million euros for World Cup tickets and an additional 1 million euro tax flat rate. But NBW's chief executive says particularly smaller companies can no longer afford that.
Was wir aber auch von vielen hören ist,
we hear from many companies that they have lost interest. In future, they want to cut back their sponsorship activities. The current investigations may indeed lead to a very sad conclusion. Sporting and cultural activities in Germany would be damaged severely.
The result is grotesque. Much needed sponsorship of sports and the arts is in danger. Sponsorship which, thanks to NBW Energy Group, has allowed Legendarios do Brasil to perform after the country's great game in Berlin. The band of six former football players who won the World Cup for Brazil in 1962 and 1970 are hoping to keep up their comrades' good spirits. Peter Zimmermann, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
That brings us to the end of this week's edition of Network Europe. From me, Hannah Godfrey, thanks for joining us. If you have any comments on the programme or if you want to listen to it again, you can log on to our brand new website, networkeurope.org.
This programme is produced with support from the European Commission.
Întorce-te, întorce-te așa la mine, amândoi s-o frigem bine. Întorce-te așa la mine, amândoi s-o frigem bine. Dum dacă dumă dacă dai dumă la la, dum dacă dumă dacă dai dumă la la, dai dumă dacă dai dumă la la, rec dacă dumă dacă dai dumă la la. Hai, don't bother. subindo.